WTBC Radio and Beautiful Anywhere Anywhen is brought to you by Livebar. Please consider reviewing this program in iTunes, and the person with the funniest review will win a box of assorted Livebars made right here in Salem, Oregon, just like this podcast. This is your chance to try these tasty treats and sharpen your wit to a razor's edge by leaving the funniest review of our program in iTunes, or send it by email, whatever works for you. livebars.com. That's Live Bar. Eat real food.
WTBC Radio. In beautiful, anywhere.
It's our conversation with Michael Pilmer. Musician, archivist, and fan. And a hardcore Devo obsessor. Sit back and let me tell you how a true fan does rock shows.
Wanting to be cool.
There's something absolutely magical about discovering your particular fan community. And it was even harder in the old days. I know people get sick and tired of us Xers talking about that, but I swear it was harder in the old days. That's just a fact. But that didn't stop us from trying to connect with each other, from trying to figure out how to fit in, what the rules, what the particular rights and traditions of these particular organizations shaped up and worked out for us. You know, it was a really clumsy, difficult time where you're, you know, certainly trying to figure it out. But you know, it took practice. It takes dedication, and sometimes the fan communities are so insular that it's difficult to penetrate them. You know, I mean, you have to have a certain desire, tendency, interest, obsession, as it were, to really keep piercing the veil, keep that magic alive, keep going to these shows where these presentations are larger than life, that fill us with joy and excitement. You know, it's hard to contain ourselves when we start talking about rock and roll. But that's what makes talking with Michael Pilmer so exciting. Like, he really is so interested in music in really exciting ways, where he's keeping track of things and archiving things and working with artists that do cool stuff but just don't, you know, have like the major label connections that they once did, perhaps. You know, his work as Devo's archivist, t-shirt printer, catch-all kind of guy really has kind of put him, in terms of fans and what fans can do, in this upper echelon of people where, like, you can walk around as someone at concerts enjoying music by people that you love. And then you can also kind of realize that these are people that you can just walk up to and work with, and they're into projects and they like your ideas. And wow, like, how cool is that to walk on both sides of the stage, so to speak? But, you know, like, we barely even scratched the surface. I feel like there's several podcasts in Michael Pilmer, because he's a musician as well as a well-rounded fan. His tastes and whatnot are pretty all over the place. He's definitely a weirdo in wonderful ways. He was in the experimental band Silica Gel, among others. But, you know, he's also just, you know, a guy who likes music and likes to play music and likes to talk about music and gets really excited about music. And that's what I love. And that's what I hope comes through in our conversation on this show. I mean, like, he's a treat to follow on social media, but I think talking to him is really where it's at. Now, I do want to make a point to mention that this might be one of the few times ever when I have been conducting these kinds of interviews where we had technical problems at the beginning of the call. And so the first 3 to 5 minutes of our conversation is lost. And so we kind of jump right into things in medias res, as they used to say, about Odysseus and his adventures. But I think we cover enough of what he's done to give you context for what we were talking about. And the 3 to 5 minutes is really just more stuff about his work with Thor and how that relationship formed. And I think that that's covered elsewhere well enough to where it's not really a mystery about that relationship. And, you know, I'm hoping that we can talk again, so perhaps we can recover what was lost in those 3 to 5 minutes. I don't think it's that much that you really, you know, but I just wanted to be honest and upfront about what happened. A little technical glitch behind the scenes, and so it goes. But I think the conversation that we do capture here is so telling of what Michael is like that, it's basically unedited, straight through. I mean, like, you know, I do maybe like a couple of snippets for because of the audio quality dropouts and whatnot, but he gets going on a tear, and I don't want to interrupt because, like, his enthusiasm seeps through the phone, and I hope that you can feel it too on the podcast, because there is nothing like someone else coming forward and saying, I like this thing and you both like it, and this absolutely tangible energy pops up between the two of you. And suddenly, like, it doesn't matter how far separated you are by time and space and whatnot, your eyes are locking, you're sweating, your pulse is quickening, you are getting ready to discuss rock and roll in its most primal form. And that is exactly what Michael Pilmer is all about.
WTBC Radio in beautiful anywhere, anywhere.
This conversation was conducted by phone on January 17th, 2018.
I picked it up and I saw an ad for new Thor album on Star USA Records out of Charlotte. And I was like, this can't be the same Thor. Why would he be on a record label out of Charlotte? It doesn't make any sense. So there was a phone number for Star USA, and I called them up. And long story short, I spoke to John on the phone, John Michael Thor, and we became friends. And I told him, hey, look, he had relocated to Charlotte with his wife years before, so he'd been living there for a while. And I told him, look, I'll help you with anything you need help with. If you need to do T-shirts, you know, like I said, if you need to do your website or whatever, just let me help you do some things. And so he did, and I convinced him to go back on tour, and we went on tour, and just started a friendship, and I just helped him however I can throughout the years.
That's incredible. You know, like, I love these stories of people who are fans first, and they're like, you know, I like this art, it speaks to me in some capacity, and then it turns out that, like, through a weird chain of events, they actually get to meet these people and participate in what they do.
Right, and sometimes you're lucky enough so that when you meet people, they're actually nice people, and you actually get along with them on a level other than just fan and artist. You know, you become friends and you talk about things other than their music, and so that just happened. Anybody who meets John, typically anybody, says he's the nicest guy in the world, and he's so passionate about what he does. So everybody wants to help him, for sure, and that's what happened to me.
That's fantastic. So you went from, like, reading about him, collecting the records, and then when you're working for him, what was kind of the first stuff that he had you do? Like, were you just answering mail order stuff, or?
No, nothing like that. I think he and his wife took care of that out of their own home. I mean, they weren't really doing a lot of mail order business, I don't think, then. But yeah, they were selling CDs, and I think they were planning a show, a reunion show. I think it was in Florida, 1997. Mm. And so he asked me. I can't remember if I asked him or he asked me, but somehow we came up with the idea that they needed a spectacular shirt for this event, since it was the first time the whole original band got together in many years. So I designed a T-shirt for him, and then I got it printed through a friend of mine. And then after that one show, they went on a tour in 1998, which I helped them with, and went along on the tour and sold merch and handed stage props and all that stuff. And it was amazing. It was an amazing, weird adventure. Yeah. And I toured him a few times over the years. It was really fun.
And that particular time period, too, the late 90s, was such a weird, you know, because, like, there was the internet's kind of just getting started. Those communities are just starting to get built. And all these people who were into niche stuff that were separated by, you know, geography were finally connecting with each other. And
that's what happened. That's what happened with the throng of Devo fans that I still go to meet once a year in Ohio for the devotional event. And we all met online back when, you know, Devo Alt.net or whatever those, I can't remember what the fucking thing was called. Alt Fan Devo, and that's what it was, Alt Fan Devo.
Yeah.
And so it was this night where everybody kind of talked about things and traded things and, you know, discussed if Devo had any shows coming up. So anyway, those people, we all decided at some point we didn't need to meet in person, and so that's why these devotional fan events sprung up. But anyway, that's getting ahead of the story. But Thor, yes, new situation. It was like full online who were Thor fans from all over the world who were wondering what he was up to, and, you know, you kind of get into a thing with those people where you're almost like family, and you're all connected by this one entity. And,
right.
Interesting.
Yeah. So when you were designing the, because I mean, I guess a better question is, did you already know HTML when you first started working on the Thor website, or?
Well, actually, when I first met, I didn't really learn HTML until about 2002, and I barely learned it. I learned just enough to get me by and to be able to use Dreamweaver and to put together really simple HTML sites, which I still, my area of web expertise doesn't go much beyond that, you know? So I just did it because it was a means to an end. I really am not a fan of computers. I don't like working on computers. I've never been into computer games or even watching screens at all. So I just did it because I really wanted to be able to make my own websites. I wanted to make my own Devo fan collection website. I wanted to show people all this stuff that I had,
right,
that I couldn't have everywhere in my house, right? So it was just a way for me to put all these photos I collected of Thor and all these bits of memorabilia and put them up in front of people so I could get fans' reactions to them, basically. I mean,
yeah.
And of course, I wanted everybody to know when these bands were having their next shows. And you're right, that was a very interesting time, because if you got your foot in the door and you learned just enough to do websites, there was a whole bunch of work for you to do automatically.
Yeah, the Merlin Mann has this excellent joke about how in those days, if you knew how to use a break tag, you were essentially valuable to a company to make their website.
Yeah, I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, like I said, I've never been addicted to any computers. I've never excelled in technology in any way. But I had to do it because I was trying to work with people at the time where I would send them information. Like, the first Devo site, I don't know who it was run by, probably somebody in California, but they were really bad with updating their site.
Mm.
And so I would always be emailing them, hey, change this page to look like this and add this image. And it got so frustrating, I just was like, I just wish I could do it myself. I hate emailing ideas to people and then waiting, and then they do it wrong, and I got to correct them. It's like, if I could just do it myself, that'd make things easier. So that's what happened, you know. It became a necessity.
That's fantastic. So when you are, I assume that you've worked with Thor in a number of ways. Now, that 2015 documentary where they have you in it, the claim to fame on that one was it's the tour that almost killed him. I bet that's a little bit of hype.
No, every tour almost killed him, believe me.
What, is that because he's a workaholic, or is that because there's actual?
He is just dedicated to his craft, and he will never not be Thor, the Rock Warrior. He always will be, and whether these tours make money or whether these albums make money or not, he's going to keep doing it. Even though he says every now and then, okay, I'm done, this is the last one, I'm going to get a call from him a couple months later saying, so we're working on a new record. It's like, okay, I didn't expect anything less, really.
He can't give it up himself. He's addicted.
Right, no.
That's fantastic.
It's a good story, because it's not like he's in a situation where he's doing music, he's making enough money so that he just has to keep doing it, because sometimes he doesn't make any money, but he keeps doing it. He's so dedicated to this idea and this craft that nothing will stop him.
That's very cool. That's very cool. Now, we started this conversation by you saying that, I mean, you're such a fan of rock and roll that you kind of couldn't help but pursue these interests. Now, I mean, do you remember first being ignited with that, like, interest of, like, oh, yes, rock and roll? You know, like, do you remember your age or?
Oh, I was, I must have been 6 or 7. Because my sister and my brother and my sister's boyfriend had, you know, records around my house. And so I would, when they were listening to their records, I would look through the liner notes and the album covers. I remember looking through ELO, you know, what are some other ones? A bunch of old classic rock stuff, ELO, AC/DC, Black Sabbath.
Right.
And I would listen to their records and then, that music, and you know, my sister and her boyfriend took me to my first Kiss concert when I was 9 or 10 in 1977.
Whoa.
And before that, I had seen my sister's friend's band, practice in a basement in Ohio. They were called Brushfire. And I think they were an AC/DC cover band, if I remember correctly. If they weren't a cover band, they sounded just like AC/DC. But I would be in this basement, this hot smoke-filled basement with my sister and her boyfriend and just watching this band and loving like the sound of the amps and how loud it was, and the little dingy, dark, you know, basement. It was just so cool. And then I saw Kiss, and then I just saw concerts for the rest of my life. Almost every week I would be somewhere seeing a concert. So
it's kind of hard, especially after seeing Kiss, too, because like that is a tremendous stage show for a kid to see. It's like, I mean, like you want to see something like that again and again.
Well, it was interesting because my first Kiss concert wasn't really all that. I mean, it was we barely got there to see it because of a snowstorm that hit Cleveland. So we were in traffic for probably 2 or 3 hours. We got there. Kiss was, I think, just about to go on. We got to our seats just in time to see a little bit of the opening band, and then Kiss came on. But we were seated so far back that they were like little ants on stage. I could barely see what was going on. My sister didn't tell me that there was a merch booth or that you can get t-shirts at concerts, so I never got a t-shirt. I was always upset with her about that. Like, how do you take me to a show and not get me a t-shirt?
Yeah, that is a given now, but like, maybe she was just not paying
attention. And I remember my sister and her boyfriend weren't really into it. Like, they were Kiss fans, kind of, but they just took me. So they weren't like really sitting there rocking out. They were just sitting in their seats, and I was sitting there like mesmerized, trying to squint, see Gene Simmons on stage. From that point on, I kind of made concerts more. I kind of always tried to be front row, center, you know, as close as possible. Always tried to get backstage, always bought a t-shirt. Like, from that point on, I did shows right.
Yeah,
I learned my lesson after that one.
That's funny how like those first formative experiences kind of changed that, because I'm a bit younger, so my mom was taking me to shows when I was a kid that were more like hair metal centric.
I love that stuff too.
Well, and like, you know, I won't trade that Bon Jovi Skid Row double bill for anything. Like, that was you know, like, that blew me away as a kid. Since then, like, I feel like my mom's type of concert going is not my type of concert going. And so you always have to like course correct as you get older, where you're like, you know, I can show up earlier. I can, you know, have a drink, you know, I can, you know, all these things kind of open up, and suddenly it's a lot more fun.
Don't stop there. I can get fucked up backstage with the band and get a free t-shirt from them.
Yeah, see, now that's living the dream.
You got to keep upping it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, that's a good kind of entree right there, because, like, I feel like there's some people who, you know, they are always professional fans and whatnot, and they love to go see shows and things like that, but you've actually been in bands, too, over the years as well. Do you remember your first band?
How could you be a fan of rock and roll and not at least try to be in a band? I mean,
exactly.
Of course. The first band that I remember was, I think, you know, actually, it's kind of embarrassing, but me and an old girlfriend started a band called, I think, Creations in the Kitchen. And basically, we took things from the kitchen, pots and pans or whatever, and made music with it and then sang over it. I don't know if we've even ever recorded anything. I can't remember. Then shortly after that, I started a band called Foaming Tonsils with two other guys in our junior high school. And we weren't really musicians. We had an acoustic guitar that somebody had at their house. We had some cardboard boxes for drums. We had a boom box that we recorded on. And we did, you know, probably 2 albums worth of material and released them just on cassette in our high school. Huh. And then we played the high school senior follies and got things thrown at us. And then that band dissolved and I formed a band called Rabid Salesman with some friends of mine. And that was a real band. You know, we had rehearsals and we had, do you hear my cats fighting?
No, actually, I don't.
Hey, guys, you fuck off, both of you. Okay, sorry. They're like howling and screaming and batting each other. I'm like, fuck, I'm trying to tell a rock and roll story.
their need for attention knows no bounds.
I know. If you want it, you can have it, but you
gotta learn to reach out there and grab it. If you are looking for professional photography and contemporary style and glamour, then J. Jean Portraits is your destination. Based right here in Salem, Oregon, just like this podcast, J. Jean Portraits can offer the right kind of photos for the project that you have in mind. To help wet the whistle of people interested in J. Jean Portraits, we are holding a contest for the person or artist who would like to do a little photo shoot on us. Please send an email to austinrich@gmail.com and explain why you should have your band, art project, or whatever photographed in a short paragraph. And the most interesting entry will receive a full photo shoot package courtesy of J. Jean Portraits. You do not want to miss out on this opportunity to get professional quality photography for free. So please enter to win a free photography package with J. Jean Portraits. That's jjeanportraits.com. A professional look tailored specifically for you.
Hey, it's snowing really good outside right now. Nice. So anyway, where was I? What was I doing when these cats started fucking howling bloody murder?
You're talking about your bands that you were in.
So the Foaming Tonsils dissolved, and we never really did anything real. We put out a couple of cassettes and played a couple of shows. But then Rabid Salesman was the first band that was a real band. We had rehearsals. We had used real musicians in the band. We had real live shows at real punk rock clubs, and we put out a record, and we did all this stuff. We were on compilations. And so that was probably from about 86 to 1992 or something. I was in that band. And then
that's a good run.
That led to a band called Silica Gel, which was a completely different style of music. It was industrial noise, kind of tape loops, kind of sound experimentation.
Collage,
yeah, beats, collage, samples, noise, kind of Skinny Puppy-ish, Severed Heads-ish, mm-hmm. That kind of stuff. So that did really well. We put out a CD, we played shows, all of them down the East Coast, like a handful of shows, and then we got distributed by Negative Land, the label. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Negative Land.
Yeah, actually, I've actually been speaking with Mark and David
for
a couple of interviews, and I was going to ask about Silica Gel.
I'm really good friends with Mark, and David and I used to hang out 20 years ago.
Oh, nice. Yeah, this was going to be another question I had, because Silica Gel is obviously kind of a little bit of a weirder thing, and Thor and Devo are definitely
the weirdest,
more in a rock and roll
thing. The weirder stuff comes right after Silica Gel.
Is that the Crapper Keeper?
Crapper Keeper, right. Then the Crapper Keeper was really insane. That was really fun. A lot of costuming involved and a lot of really immature humor and really taboo subjects. And we put out a cassette and we put out some stuff on compilations and we did a lot of shows and kind of made a little impact as being one of the weirder elements of the scene down here.
Yeah.
And then that turned into a weird band called Banana Twins, which was not performance oriented, but just studio sound manipulations and again, stupid, taboo, immature, subject matter. But it was just really fun. It made us laugh really hard. So we kept doing things like that.
Sure.
And then I was in Thor and the Ass Boys with Thor. And then, did some drum and bass stuff under the name, Tourette Posse or something like that. I can't remember the name of the band.
That's a great name, though.
Something. I can't remember the name of the band. I'll have to look it up before you publish it.
Well, yeah, I had a couple questions about some of these groups here, because like that, you know, so you
Motor Tick Posse. That's what it was. Motor Tick Posse.
Ah, not, that's right. I did see that name somewhere when I was doing some research.
Yeah, so anyway, I dip my hand in a lot of little news projects when I can. But
yeah, well, I'm kind of curious about this because you say you're like, you know, I'm a rock and roll fan growing up, and you're talking about Kiss and Thor, but where's all this kind of weird influence coming from? Is that all Devo or
no, not at all. I mean, I used to do weird stuff when I was a kid. We used to do found sound and tape manipulations when I was a little kid. Well, there was this record called Mr. Jaws, I think, when I was a kid. And
the bass was Dickie Goodman.
It was a comedy record, and I just remember he took parts of other songs and put them together to be his own kind of thing, his own creation. And I had never heard anything like that before, so me and my friends started doing that. And that led to us putting bits of songs, plus bits of stuff that we would record, you know, us laughing, our own farts, you know, whatever it was. So then we started piling all this stuff into the recordings, and I didn't really know it was anything. I didn't know there were things called, you know, sound manipulation or industrial music or anything like that. This is way before industrial music, I think. But sure. Anyway, it was just playing with sound. I've always been interested in playing with sound, I mean, I don't know any young male who gets a tape recorder before he's 10 and doesn't fart into it. But we did that a lot, and I actually still have recordings of farts from 1982.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was just, we were always interested in sound and laughing. And
all of my kid tapes are gone, and I wish, oh man, that's the one thing, you know, I'm kind of okay with some of the books and the teddy bears and things like that, but look, that box of tapes from when I was like 10. Oh.
Yeah, I know. See, when I first got the technology to take, or when people that I knew first had the technology to take a tape and put it on CD, the tape of farts was one of the first things I went for, and I said, this has to be saved.
Rightly so. This, for the future needs to hear this, you know? Like.
Well, you know, and when I was finally able to put a ringtone on my phone that I could design myself, I put Farts from 1982 on it as a ringtone, of course. So, that's where I was interested in sound. But then when I would buy these Kiss magazines in the 70s, and I still have them all, Cream and Circus and all these magazines with Kiss, and then I would buy anything with Kiss on the cover, or my mom would. And, at the back of these magazines in the late 70s, they started springing up these sections for punk rock or new wave bands. And so I would look at those, and at first I would, just shrug them off and say, oh, that's that dumb punk stuff, whatever, people were in jeans, fuck that, I want to see Kiss, right? But then I would get more curious and more curious and start investigating the Ramones and Blondie and the Nuns and Vom and all these just weird bands that would pop up in the back of these rock mags. So then that led to that. And then in the mid-80s, when I came to college, some people introduced me to really strange stuff, like The Residents and Ronaldo and Loaf. And, I was already into Skinny Puppy from high school, and a friend of mine who went to Canada and kind of met those guys in the early days came back with this news that there's this band called Skinny Puppy, you're going to love them. It sounds like, you know, horror soundtrack rock and roll music. So I was like, yeah,
that's
great.
That's
so
the best description
this is how
I've
we discovered. Yeah, it's like, you know, a bunch of scary music with a good, like, rap beat to it almost. So it was great. So I just picked up on all this stuff and was interested right off the bat in that kind of left of center, not mainstream, not radio friendly stuff for the most part.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of funny because I knew you as, you know, the Devo Obsesso and through the Thor fan club. And then when I'm like, oh, well, I should look into some of his music, and I'm like, I know Silica Gel. You know, it was like,
how did you know Silica Gel?
I'm a big Negative Land fan, and so I would comb
That's
through
amazing.
Their Sealand catalog, just kind of looking for other stuff that was like Negative Land, because, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and so.
Yeah, I mean, that just got reissued on vinyl a year or two ago.
How cool is that? Because, I mean, that original recording, like, was that done at home, or what? How did you make those?
It was done at one of my friend's houses. I think my friend Chris, who was the other guy in the band, he probably had all of his stuff set up in his house and all his I never had any musical equipment. I may have owned a guitar or an amp once in my life, but he had all the samplers and the keyboards and all the stuff we would need. So, yeah, we probably recorded at his house. Yeah.
Mm, right on.
And not like I needed a studio to record that stuff. We just.
It's kind of funny to go from like that where it's got this very intimate you and your friend making a record sound to it, and then it's like, yeah, it's being reissued on this vinyl that's, you know, being shipped out all over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who needs a studio nowadays to record music? But even then, with floppy disks and with keyboards and with being able to sit down and just kind of pluck out music by hitting little knobs and buttons, mm-hmm. I mean, you didn't really need a studio. You needed somebody who knew how to mix those sounds together or separate those sounds or bring out what you wanted to bring out, but you really didn't need a studio.
Yeah, yeah. So you're growing up and you're collecting records, going to concerts.
I'm not sure I ever grew up.
Fair enough. You know, I'm standing in my room with my comic books and my guitars, and I'm like, oh, maybe I didn't grow up either.
don't rush into it.
Yeah. But I like this transition because you're buying records, you're collecting, you're going to shows and things like that. And so you start doing the Thor fan site, but then this Devo Obsesso thing where you're archiving Devo artifacts, was that something that started earlier than the website launch? Or I feel like you probably were collecting Devo stuff for a while.
Yeah, well, I started really heavily collecting in 1988 after I saw them on their reunion. Well, I don't know if it was a reunion tour, but it was a first tour they'd done in many years, and I never got to see them in the early 80s because they were never playing around where I was, or I never found out about the show. You know, you kind of had to be in on some kind of news, river of news to get those show, I mean, to see the show ads or whatever. And North Carolina wasn't really big on that kind of stuff. So anyway, I missed out on my early Devo shows. So when I saw them in 88, I met all these fans who, collected Devo in various ways. Like one guy collected bootleg tapes, like live recordings, and I don't even know if I even thought of that, like that Devo recordings would exist, you know, that weren't released. So right. That opened my mind up to the whole world of collecting rare stuff, and then I started buying bootleg records and when I could, and communicating with all these other Devo fans and trading things and figuring out what's out there. And so then that, me getting a relationship with Devo fans online through these early news groups and such, there was always kind of need to want to show them, hey, I got this rare thing. How do I show you these guys all this cool rare stuff I have? So I would be posting things to Alt Fan Devo, and I just decided, man, it'd be great if I just had one website where I could just put everything and then update it. So that way, when I'm out shopping for records, I can look at the website and go, oh yeah, I already have that. I don't need to buy that again.
Right.
Because I would get every kind of pressing I could find, you know. So, to know if I had the Taiwan promo or the German test pressing or whatever, I would be able to look on my site and find out. So,
check the matrix number, make sure it's not, you know, the later one.
Right. And I remember in the early days when me and the Devo fans would talk, we would call each other Devo geeks. We were just Devo geeks. We were like the people that collected Devo. I mean, there were Dungeons and Dragons geeks, there were video game geeks, there were computer geeks, but we were the Devo geeks.
Right.
So initially that was kind of like my tagline was Devo geek. But then I decided that I didn't like that tagline as much, and so I kind of wanted something that sounded more like it was from the Devo aesthetic. So I said, well, I got to figure out a brand for myself. Like, what would be the brand for the ultimate Devo fan, the ultimate collector? Devo Obsesso sounds good. It has a nice ring to it. So that's what I went with. I just thought, well, that'll be my tagline. That'll be my name. And I'll be the guy that collects all the Devo, and, you know, people will come to me if they want to know what exists, and, you know, I'll get people offering to trade me stuff because they'll know I'm the, you know, number one collector or whatever. That was my idea.
Right. Yeah. Well, and this is in an era too. We were kind of stressing this a little bit earlier, but that late 90s period, like, the internet was like this real wild west where it hadn't really been completely settled yet. People were kind of just free-for-alling in terms of what your websites could be. And there was a lot of these like niche things that were being made by people that felt like a passion project. Like you could see the hours that they cared about this thing in whatever the final result was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree.
Mm, I'm just kind of curious. You're in this community and putting it together. You've got basic, rudimentary website stuff, but you know, Devo Obsesso feels like a slightly bigger project. Was it all you, or did you have any help?
Not all me. No, not at all. No, I mean, that's all just simple HTML there. I mean, it's not the best site in the world, and I would change a lot of things if I could, but it works for me, and the information is there if people want to find it, and I still use it as reference. I mean, I still go there, and, you know, when I need to figure out, well, who took that photo, or what cover did the German release of blah, blah, blah have, and go look it up, or if I, you know, have something, whether I have something or not in my collection, I go use it. So, it's just, you know, it's not supposed to be flashy, whiz-bang, the best site in the world, but it is supposed to be useful and updated all the time. And that's the thing. Like, a lot of people back then, they would start a website, and even now, people will start a website and then never update it again, and then eventually the website just crumbles and falls apart. And I just promised myself I would never let that happen. I would never go through an initial period of passion with it and then forget about it. Mm-hmm. So, it just, you know, every time I get something new, I got to put it up there. And sometimes it takes me a few months to get it up there, but I will always update that site.
Right. So
it's an obligation, you know?
Yeah. Then how did you go from having it be something that's your project to having a relationship with Devo themselves?
Okay, well, that's kind of a long story, but I'll make it the Cliff Notes version. At some point in the 90s, mid-90s, early-90s, I was homesick. I had the flu. I was home from school for maybe a few days in a row, and at some point I got really bored, and I started calling information on people that I used to know in Ohio, where I grew up, old school friends and stuff. And I think I was probably listening to Devo in my room at the time, and I started hitting all these dead ends with things I was looking for, and I thought to myself, hey, Devo's from Ohio. I wonder if anybody in Devo still lives in Ohio. So I started getting interested in any Mother's Baws or Casalis, and I wasn't really having any luck with Mother's Bob, but then I looked for a Bob Casali, and I got a number, and I called it, and a voice answered, an older man, and he said, hello, and I said, I'm looking for a Bob Casali. I'm not sure if I have the right number. And he was like, oh yeah, that's my son. He's in Devo. I was like, oh. I was like, great. Well, you know, I'm in this band, Silica Gel. We just put out a record. This is like 1993. Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to send it to him to get his opinion because I consider them an influence. Doesn't sound like Devo, but still very influential, and I want to get him a copy. And he said, well, you should just call him up. I can give you his number in L.A. And I was like, no, I don't need to call. I can just, if you just give me an address, I'll send it to him. No, go ahead and call him up. He's up here coming. So he gives me Bob's number. I call Bob's house. I end up speaking to his wife because Bob is out working with Mark on something. And his wife graciously talks to me, and we talked for hours, and we became friends. And then shortly after that, me and my girlfriend visited L.A. for the first time. And we told Bob and Lisa. And they invited us to stay at their house in their guest room. So our Whoa. First time to L.A., we stayed in their guest room. And we became friends. And then they introduced me to Mark and Jerry. And Mark and Jerry and I really got along well. And I started getting screen printing stuff for Mark. They're making all of their old Devo shirts for their tours that they started doing in the mid-late 90s. You know, Lollapaloozas and so,
got it.
We just, and I had a real job then. I was a marketing director for a software company. So I was just helping Devo as kind of a hobby.
Something to do on the weekends.
Well, I just wanted to help them. And I wanted to make sure their websites were updated and the merch looked good and it was, you know,
right.
The merch looked like it should. And I was just really into the Devo aesthetic and their graphics. So
yeah. Well, and there's something about the Devo idea that lends itself to internet culture. There feels like there should be a representation of it somewhere, you know.
Well, yeah, of course. So when I found out the site wasn't being updated and I was missing information and shows that were coming up, because shows were very few and far between back then, and so to miss hearing about an announcement of a show and not being able to go was hard to deal with. So I said, fuck it, I'm going to be the guy to make sure this is updated so that I don't miss any info anymore.
Yeah. Well, and now you've actually got like an inside track, so you can actually get something current when you want it.
Right. Well, so then after 9/11 and we had this .com, whatever fallout, whatever they called it, the software industry kind of took a dive.
Right.
You know, traveling on planes to trade shows kind of took a dive. So I got laid off from my marketing director job. And that's the first time I ever lost a job in my life. Hmm. So I was kind of stressed out and I was putting in resumes for about 6 to 9 months and, you know, the guys in Devo knew what I was going through, and eventually I contacted one. I was like, look, you know, the stuff I've been doing for free. I was like, how about you pay me just a little bit per month, maybe as much as I would make on unemployment. Mm. And I'll keep doing that for you while I look for another job. So that happened, and then as time went on, I just kept adding to my responsibilities, and they kept paying me a little more and more. I started touring with them and helping them on tour with the wardrobe and props and whatnot. And so it just kind of grew and grew and grew. That's, and I'm still doing it somehow.
That's fantastic. See, again, another one of these stories of somebody who, you know, like, so from my perspective, I bonded with Devo very late, but it was that, you know, first record, the Are We Not Men, that really kind of spoke to me as like a early 20s, you know, kind of a malaffected person trying to figure things out.
Sure.
And their songs are such a clear mission statement of like, yeah, you know, there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. You're part of the, you know, new devolved world. And it really, you know, and so I love the idea of like having something that speaks to you so clearly as a young person. And then like years later, you're like in the cafe going like, well, we got to eat before we hit the road to the next show. Mark, what do you want?
Yeah, well, you know, it happened almost exactly like that for me. When I was a kid, I didn't really hear Devo. I got a very late start on Devo. I didn't hear them until Whippet came out in 1980, and I had already moved out of Ohio. And I was living in North Carolina for maybe a couple of years at that point. And I was amazed that this great band that I all of a sudden fell in love with was from Ohio, where I was from. They were like, right, they were from Akron. I was from Stowe, which is like basically the same neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So I was like thinking to myself, how did I miss out on guys? I was up there living when they were starting, when they were playing around, and I have no idea. And so then I started trying to play catch up. Like, okay, I'm never going to miss a Devo show from now on. I'm never going to, you know, I'm going to always try to be up on what they're doing. So I remember sitting on a park bench or something in 1982, and me and my friend were sitting there, and I had my boombox, my cassette boombox, and I was blasting Devo, Oh No, It's Devo. Mm. And I remember telling my friend, you know, I just wish, I was like, if I had one wish, I was like, I just wish I could call these guys up and ask them questions about these songs, because all the songs really spoke to me. Every album, I was like, you know, they were speaking to me about, you know, don't trust religion, don't trust authority.
Yes.
And they saw things the way I kind of saw things, and that not a whole lot of people around me in North Carolina or Ohio saw things. So I really related to them on a lot of levels. And so then one day I was able to call Jerry and say, hey, so about this lyric, and I'll let you call.
Yeah.
What's that about?
I think the lesson learned here is that when you make a wish upon a boombox, anything is possible.
Yeah, I should have wished a little more. I should have wished for a lot of money to go along with this. And,
sure.
I should have wished for a lot more, but the wish I made did come true.
Yeah. WTBC Radio is also sponsored by Peggy's Vegan Hot Sauce. Locally made in Portland, Oregon, Peggy's sauce is 100% vegan and 100% ready for you to experience a taste explosion you'll want again and again. Available in 3 flavors, Hotter Melon, Ghost Berry, 5-Star Gary, Carolina Reaper. That's with avocados. For more information about Peggy's sauce, including ordering inquiries, please visit Peggy's Vegan Hot Sauce, all one word, on either Facebook or Instagram. Let me say it one more time. Peggy's Vegan Hot Sauce. When you need a little something with an extra kick. Well, and then like in other things too came true as well, because we got off track a tiny bit, but so you make that Silica Gel album. How did Negative Land contact you about distributing it? Was that
We had met them because I can't remember if it was because we were in the same circles of people that traded tapes, read stuff, or I don't remember exactly how we met them. Maybe it was a show they played in North Carolina, but somehow we met them and we gave them some cassettes or whatever what we did, and then we sent them a CD when the CD came out, because we released it ourselves at first.
Right.
And then as soon as it came out, we sent them a copy, and then I think Mark really loved it, and he said, hey, maybe we can help you guys distribute this. And we were like, great. So they said, okay, we'll just add a UPC sticker to it, seal and DPC, and then we'll distribute it for you. And then that really took off for us. We started getting reviews and you know, good magazines. I think Spin magazine did something, or, you know, Alternative Press, and all these magazines were doing things. And so we got great attention. And then that kind of, you know, is what got it to be reissued so many years later. Because so many fans like you of Negative when I discovered it. And then this one fan who knew it from back in the day had a wild hair, and he said, I want to start a label and I want to release your record. And I said, okay.
How can you turn
it's
down
never
going to
happen any other way. So yeah, let's do it.
This is the funny part, is that, like, you know, a lot of people are always like tentative about approaching artists with these ideas. And the other side of the coin is that we're all sitting there at home going like, man, I just wish somebody would give you some money so I could release this record.
Well, you know, it wasn't even, I didn't get any money for it. It was just like, and my former band member, Chris, he doesn't really want to have anything to do with the band anymore. So it's basically up to me what happens with it. Mm. And I was like, look, man, if you put this record out, spend all your hard-earned money to do it, I'll sign off on it. Just give me, you know, whatever makes sense, portion of the records and a test pressing and whatever, and we're good. So that's what happened. And he let me do all the design work, and he gave me full open budget for whatever I wanted to do with the design, basically any bells and whistles. And so it was great. It was really fun. It was interesting. Yeah, it was kind of stressful because I wanted everything to be perfect, of course. So
yeah. Well, and I think one thing that you are very good at is attention to detail. So I imagine, like, you know, it wasn't just kind of like a, well, just let it happen. You really...
No, I had to, like, it was really a chore, because I thought initially I could just take the old CD cover artwork and blow it up and it'd be fine. No, it wasn't going to work at all. So I had to kind of do everything from scratch. I had to find the original slide of the photo and rescan it and then manipulate it to look like the CD cover was cropped. And then I basically relay out the whole thing, which took months, but it was worth doing. It was good.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny too, because, like, we keep going through these phases where each new era of rock and roll is being rediscovered and re-archived, you know, because, like, we had that era where everybody was, like, excited about the 60s. People are getting excited about the 70s, and I think finally, like, the 80s and 90s are being examined, and, you know, some of these gems that slipped through the cracks maybe the first time around are getting their due.
That's great. I love it. I got no complaints.
Right on. Another project that I am a big fan of, that I see that you have a little bit of production credit on, is the Hardcore Devo records for the 2013 release. What was your, how did you connect to that?
Well, I mean, I was working for the band, obviously, and most all of the invitations to release things went through me first. People would reach out, labels, and say, hey, we'd love to release a Devo record. What do you have?
Right.
And I'd say, well, let me talk to the band. And I'd call the band and I'd say, hey, we have that hardcore stuff that hasn't been reissued. Why don't we do that? And we could put some bonus tracks and we could do this and that. And they'd be, okay, that sounds great. And so then I'd get in touch with the label and I'd say, okay, let's work all the details out. And then when we have something substantial to show them, I'll run it by them. And so I just kind of helped manage the whole project aesthetically and made sure that we got the right songs out of the archive and they were mastered correctly. And, you know, I listened to the test pressing and approved it. That was kind of my role. I mean, the label, of course, did all the real design work, and I would just research all of the imagery and make sure everybody was credited. And
got it.
That kind of thing.
Well, and you know, I can't imagine, you know, every band needs somebody like you, a dedicated fan, to kind of help with that stuff, because I could totally see the wrong person just half-assing projects like that.
Well, most people who try to put Devo stuff together without getting the band involved kind of do something that looks kind of jackass. Like, sometimes when Virgin or Warner Brothers will put out stuff like best of compilations, they'll put, like, a logo from one era and then a photo from another era and completely just wrong graphics. You know, if you're a hardcore fan or a purist, you would look at it and go, oh, that just looks like a bootleg or something. That doesn't look like a real Devo release.
Right.
So, you know, it's all about keeping everything. It's like, I don't know, it's like putting the Sgt. Pepper's Beatles logo next to a picture of them with the wigs and the skinny ties. You know, it's like,
right,
it doesn't work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it just sends a sloppy message that, like, you know, we care about this band only enough to sell this best of record.
Yeah, we thought this was a cool logo and this is the picture you guys love, so here, take it.
Yeah.
I just like to make sure everything is on point. I mean, the last many Devo releases that have come out, I don't know, for the last 8 years or something, you know, I've totally managed the projects from top to bottom, except for maybe one or two. So, but it's just, I feel like it's my obligation. I feel like if I don't do it, it might not be as good as it could be because I just happen to know or I happen to have access to all these archives where I could check the validity of things or the dates of occurrences. And, you know, the band doesn't remember all that stuff. And they get things wrong sometimes. So after they approve something, and then I look at it, I'm like, oh, guys, this is wrong. This picture's wrong. The date's wrong on this. You know, they don't know. So so it's just my role. It's the cross I bear.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful cross to bear, too, because, you know, I just remember as somebody who would look at the internet a lot in the late 90s and early 2000s that, you know, there was one place that Devo fans inevitably ended up. And it was a nice place to find like people who were not only part of the community, but just like, I need to hear that. I want to listen to that record. I want to see that bootleg. You know, like there's so many like things about it that was very compelling in those days. And so I just have fond memories. So.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So I saw that a post somewhere on the internet where you were talking about working on a book layout, and that
Devo.
Really intrigued me. That's a Devo book.
Yeah, we've been working on it for years, and this week is really we're finalizing all the layouts. You know, right before you called, I was working on, you know, trying to reach out to photographers last minute who haven't contacted us about rights to their photos, and if we don't get in touch with them, we have to replace the photo with something else. So I'm digging through the archives for similar photos to replace one that we couldn't find rights for. You know, it's down to the wire. So probably by tomorrow or definitely Monday, we'll have to have everything signed and sealed and delivered to the printer. So it's down, you know, it's like all these years of work and it's finally down to like the last little bit.
Wow. See, I didn't even realize it was that close. You know, I had just kind of read this thing and I was like, oh, I'll ask them about the book. That's fantastic. So, for people who don't know, is this like a coffee table book or what is this?
Yeah, the idea was for it to be the first kind of, Devo book by Devo and, you know, an art book, an informative art book, a coffee table book, if you will. But yeah, so, It's been something that I just wanted to be the book that both Devo and their fans are very proud of and happy with. Right. And that's really tricky because a lot of times Devo isn't happy with projects that come out in their names. Like, I really have to make sure, you know, they like as much as they can. And there's always things that we wanted to do with it that reality said we can't do with it, budget or whatever, time constraint. But for the most part, I think it's great and I think everybody's going to be happy with it.
Yeah, I've heard them complain about some of the Enigma Records era stuff that just
That was just bad record deals and bad luck. Yeah,
yeah. But they were even, I think, commenting on some of the art stuff where it felt like it wasn't quite up to the usual Devo level. You know.
Yeah, probably because they didn't do it themselves like they used to. They were probably sidetracked with real life or, you know, making money other ways.
Sure. Really. Aren't we all?
Maybe it was a daunting task to come up with new graphics for Devo. I don't know, but
yeah. Well, and this is something you are very keenly keyed into as the Devo obsesso. But like their visual representation as a band is something that is so unique and so specific, and it tells this story. Especially if you kind of go back to the pseudo subgenius origins of Devo and whatnot, like. It's a visual story that is not the same for any other band.
Well, and also you have to remember that it's a visual story that's not the same from album to album. I mean, they changed their whole entire aesthetic per album, and it was very calculated, and God bless, you know, Jerry and Mark for being that dedicated to it. Mm-hmm. But every album has a different vibe, a different, completely different look, and that's what's really... That's why I keep telling the publishers is like Devo is the band with the most like kind of aesthetic archival history.
Yeah.
Like almost any band. I mean, because Kiss, for the most part, they had the same look through the years. They changed the costume a little bit here and there, but you know, Kiss had their one kind of one thing, and then but Devo was all over the place. And then they, of course, they're only known for their red hats, the energy domes, but
which is such a shame too, because while that is an iconic look, like. I mean, if you see any of these videos from that area where they have the elaborate costume changes throughout the show, where they're, you know, essentially the look is devolving throughout the performance. it is like a weird time capsule of like, oh yeah, they had that era too.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, it's interesting because you'd think a lot of bands, if they had a hit album like Freedom of Choice, their very first big hit record, and they had this look that became very iconic, some bands might have just ridden with that same look the rest of their career. They would have been, every other album would have the Energy Domes, but not Devo. They were like, okay, well, that looks done. It was really popular. And now let's go on to the next one, Rubber Hair. And then let's go on to the next one, like these Spud Collars. And let's go on. They just kept pushing. They just, yeah. You know, no matter how much, probably I'm only assuming managers and saying, oh, where are the red hats? We need the red hats on this album. You know, what's this black Reagan hair stuff? We don't understand. So it was great that they continuously pushed their different aesthetics.
Yeah. Well, and so few bands are able to capture a satiric pop aesthetic, you know, like,
right.
I mean, there was something
in a smart way.
Yeah, exactly. There's something about it where it's like I could totally see people loving that fashion choice, and it's a commentary on that kind of nonsense fashion choice.
Exactly. Well, making a serious social statement while, you know, being able to dress up in these ridiculous, often not very comfortable outfits was great. I mean, it was a great balance of humor and satire and wit.
Yeah.
And a good, healthy dose of deviance, too.
Well, I'm glad that there's going to be a book that kind of captures this, because, like, I feel like of any band...
I hope it captures it.
Hmm?
I hope it captures it. It's hard for me to judge what the book is at this point, because I've seen all these pictures 100 times, 1,000 times, and it's hard for me to even remember what is really rare and what's not, because I've seen them for now the last, I don't know, 6 years we've been working on this book. So,
right. Your perspective is very different.
Yeah, so I really, you know, I wish I could share the final layout to some Uber fan and just get their initial reaction. I kind of want to be there when people look at the book over their shoulder, like fly on the wall, and just see the reaction, because I don't know if I could have that fan reaction anymore.
Right. Well, and it's a different thing than, you know, seeing all these photos that you can thumb through on your phone to a in your lap book that has like weight to it. So that's the thing I'm excited about is
and captions for, you know, most of the photos and little stories from the band about how this happened or what they remembered from that day, or, you know, that's what I'm really looking forward to seeing reactions to as well.
Yeah. Do you have any sense of when this might come out?
It's supposed to be May.
Wow. Oh god, the clock is ticking. My gosh.
Well, yeah, I mean, it'll be fine. If it comes out before August, I think the band will be happy. August is the 40th anniversary of the first album. Mm. And then every year after this, for the next 10 years, will be the 40th anniversary for some album, I think. So,
right.
It's a good time to release the book. It's a good year. And if it comes out between May and August, I think everything's going to be great.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. We'll have to chat again after the book comes out and talk about how it did and stuff. Because, like, I'm always very curious about these kinds of things because we live in this digital era. People are obsessed with like, oh, I got a new thing for my Nook. I want to know if books are surviving.
I think books will always be around, but I think this is certainly a collectible rather than just a book. It's not going to be a book that you can go to, you know, any bookstore and pick off the shelf. It's going to be something you have to special order. It's a very limited edition. So it's kind of more than a book. It's a thing. It's a sacred, holy totem. It's more than just a book.
It's like a Devo Subgenius text or something.
Sure. Yeah. But so what I was thinking is I've been messing around with doing Facebook Live videos. I've just done a couple, just seeing if they work and if I have the technology to do it. And I think I might have the technology to do kind of okay ones. And so I'm thinking that after the book comes out and people get their books, and, you know, later this year when a lot of people have a copy of it, I'm going to do a live video, maybe on the Devo site, maybe on my personal site, but a live video that basically says, okay, I've got the book here in front of me. You guys can ask me whatever you want about anything in the book. And so then people would post questions and I would go to the picture and go, oh, okay, yeah, that one. Well, that one is actually the one. And so whatever info isn't in the book, maybe I could provide via this live stream.
That would be a perfectly awesome archival document as well, because I mean,
sure. And if I could get, if I can get Jerry or somebody to join me, if I could go out to LA, that would be cool. But I mean, realistically, it would be easier for me to do it in my house and by myself.
Oh, for sure, for sure, for sure. Wow, that's something I would look forward to quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, me too. Because that would give me an indication of what people were drawn to, what they wanted to know about. Mm-hmm. Some, I mean, I'm sure I'd get feedback on people's favorite and least favorite pictures or whatever.
Oh yeah, there's one thing that the world of fans loves to do, and that's give opinions.
Oh man, Devo fans are great for that.
Yeah. I have.
They're also really great. They're really great investigators. You know, if they see something they think is wrong or out of place or a date that's wrong, they will figure it out.
Yeah, the community will help you on that.
Yeah, exactly. Which is good.
Yes, that is our conversation with Michael Pilmer, Devo obsesso, musician, cool dude all around. I recommend checking him out on social media, following him and whatnot. And the book that he was talking about in the interview, I think he's about to come out, actually. So please keep your eyes peeled for that. It's going to be a very cool collection of rare Devo images and photos and whatnot. And yeah, if you're a fan at all, you're going to want to check this thing out. And, you know, check out the work of Michael Pilmer. He's does these amazing Facebook videos where he kind of shows off parts of his collection. There's a really great one where he defaces a magazine in real time and talks about his process. All sorts of fun things on his social media accounts. And he's a genuine true fan who will go to great lengths to find new ways to engage with the thing that he loves. And I mean, I wish we could all strive for something like that. Our theme music is by Laura and Paco Jones, and our closing music is by the band X. Please check us out on the interwebatron anywhereanywhen.wordpress.com. and if you are not busy on May 13th, come see us live. We're going to do a really fun show with Red Panda Death March and Root Directory. They're going to be playing live. I'm going to be chatting with those groups. And I think we're even going to have some live comedy, if I'm not mistaken. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's the WTBC Radio Variety Show in beautiful Anywhere, Anywhen, a subsection of the Space Concert Club here in Salem, Oregon. So that's a Sunday night. Should be a lot of fun, and I hope to see you there. And let's give it up for our sponsors as well. You know, we've got some cool things going with them, and your support and love helps us as well. So please check out Peggy's Vegan Hot Sauce, J. Jean Portraits, and course, Live Bar. These are cool things that I actually like. You know, I'm trying to keep all of these business deals, things that I can handshake myself, and within the realm of stuff that I actually support. All three of these are cool businesses that are neat local things, and that's kind of how we like to roll. So if you are into that as well, you know, the internet is also our locality, so please keep that in mind. As long as I can give a virtual handshake to you personally on this kind of thing, let's move forward, because I really want to continue to bring these interviews to you, to try to find new ways to present these conversations with people that don't get a lot of representation any other way. You know, I'm talking too much, and you probably got things to do. You know, there's another Greatest Generation that you need to enjoy. So please, let me say, you guys are wonderful. You guys are beautiful. And without you, there would be no program. Be seeing you. So I want to talk about the value of the rock and roll pin or badge or however the kids are referring to them right now.
That is close to my heart. That's close to my heart.
Well, and this is the thing that I remember so much as a kid is that, like, you know, you go to these shows, you see these people, they have such awesome gear, and they're all wearing these badges that are like, this is the tribe. Like, these are the people I align with. And that instantly felt to me like, I want to be a part of this, you know? And I feel like that's something that you kind of relate to.
Well, yeah, it was an easy way. You know, back when I was in junior high school, this was in the early 80s, I had a jean jacket. It was a dark blue jean jacket, I remember. Maybe it was black. I can't remember. But anyway, it was a jean jacket. And down each side of the chest, of each side of the jacket, pinback buttons, completely covering each side from the collar down to the, almost down to the belt area, was just pins. And it was really heavy with pins. And it was great because I could wear all these bands that I was into. And then if somebody I met in the hallway was into one of those bands, that was a clue to me that, hey, I could probably hang out with those people if they recognize what I'm wearing, right?
Right.
So that was a really nice way for a geeky weirdo outcast person like me to meet other geeky weirdos.
Right.
And it still works. I mean, I wear pinbacks on every jacket everywhere. I never wear a jacket without a pinback button. There's three.
Oh,
so,
yeah. I've got a nice little bin of them next to my bed, and as I'm getting ready, I'll pick out a couple for my jacket if I realize I'm short that week.
For sure. And, you know, and nowadays, I don't wear any of my old vintage ones. I try to pick them up cheap. If I see a record store with some, you know, illegally made bootleg buttons, I'll buy a couple just so I have, you know, one to wear and one to keep, you know, so if it pops off somewhere and I lose it, you know, that's the most depressing thing. But, you know, I'm so into it that I figured out ways to, like, kind of duct tape behind the button to keep them from popping off. Typically on my jackets, I'll have my pinback buttons kind of fashioned so they don't pop off so easily.
This is funny because I actually was at a show where I saw a couple guys talking about this very subject of, like, how to keep your buttons from coming off your jacket.
I mean, if somebody would steal this idea from me and just send me a few of them to make them, if somebody could just devise a little something, a little plastic thing with a sticky glue part on it where you could just kind of stick it on the back of the pin that would hold the clamp down without getting pulled off. I mean, I would buy 100 of those, 300 of those. I would buy them.
Oh, yeah.
And use them on all the pinback buttons. I would use them all the time. But someone just needs to design it and finance it.
Well, and this is, this is something that I don't think people thought of up until, like, maybe in the last 10 years or so. I never thought of collectible buttons for the longest time. And, you know,
really? No, it's been a thing since the 70s.
Yeah, and I'm sure that it has, too, just from my perspective. But I just remember...
I mean, the collectibility of it has been since the 70s. There were really early punk badges made by... I can't remember the name of the company, but it was like, you know, some really kind of generic name for a badge company. Mm-hmm. And they made all the first Ramones buttons, the first, you know, Blondie buttons, the first... all these New York bands. There's just one guy that made all the first buttons, and those are highly collectible these days.
Well, yeah, and this is the thing I regret is that I remember as a kid, you know, not realizing I see thrift stores full of these buckets of old buttons and pins and things.
You see thrift stores full of old buttons?
Well, I used to when I was like a kid.
Oh, yeah.
You know, nowadays, all that stuff's dried up, you know.
Oh, man, I can't tell you how happy I am when, you know, lately over the last 10 years, when I go into a junk shop or thrift store and I see a bucket of pinbacks, I'll spend however long it takes to dump them all out and look through every single one of them. I cannot pass that up. That's one of my favorite things to do is to look through random buckets of buttons for sale.
And they used to be so much more plentiful is what I remember.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Like, you go to these weird, like, flea markets and whatnot, and they just be like buckets of them, you know. And now,
and
there were
gumball machines. Mm-hmm. There were gumball machines with buttons in them. And I still have some of those that I got out of a machine in the 80s.
Well,
it was a cool culture thing, and now they're really popular. These little enamel kind of shaped limited edition pins that people sell now.
Oh yeah,
you know, they're selling for $10 or $20 each sometimes.
It's funny too because the retro aesthetic keeps like reintroducing them to younger generations before they realize what it's. You know, like they're seeing like Bratz dolls and whatnot wear little badges, and they're like, "Oh, cool!" And then like there's this whole other like longevity behind that imagery that they're seeing.
Yep. Yep, for sure.
WTBC.